Well, hello and welcome to the ADA Shop Talk podcast. I'm your host, Paul Klein. And if you are an ADA coordinator, government official, architect, or accessibility specialist trying to better understand this wide world of the ADA, then you, my friend, are in the right place. The ADA Shop Talk podcast is brought to you by BlueDag. Check out BlueDag's Transition Plan Builder and Inspection Suite over at BlueDag.com. We got lots of great stuff over there for you. And man, it is a beautiful day. I'm recording this the week of March 11th, and it's sunny. I don't know where you are, but oh man, it's a beautiful day, beautiful week. I'm excited. I hope you're excited too. Good energy here this morning. I've had my coffee, and I'm so glad you're joining me this week. Maybe I can be a bright voice in your day and make things just a little better. So today we're going to talk about a couple things about elections and polling places. I mean, it's voting season, right? Election year, presidential election, all kinds of big issues, and we're not going to talk politics here, but yeah, anytime you got an election year, you title to election and poll workers and those responsible for accessibility and polling places and election facilities have a big task at your hands. And so I thought we'd riff on a little bit of that today and just kind of, you know, give you some tips. Now, these tips I prepared today, you know, hopefully you're starting to see a little bit of a theme here that some of this stuff that Paul talk about is Paul's interpretation or Paul's experience, and it's not necessarily official. So you've got to take everything I say with a grain of salt. However, I'm very practical and I try to give people, you know, just common sense, tactical things that we can do. I'm a problem solver naturally, so I like to figure out how to make things work, not how to not make them work. and that's the problem with regulation. Sometimes it doesn't always fit into reality. And election and polling places is a tough one. I think the biggest problem for most election officials challenges is my experience has been is I remember I used to vote. I used to live in Northern California in a rural area and we voted in a prune dryer. You know, it was up north of town and in the middle of an orchard, and it was a nice flat lot. But it was like a way station for all the prunes. You know, it was a fruit country there, fruit trees, prunes and oranges and all kinds of stuff. They had a nice little counter and they had a temporary parking stall with a cone, you know, and I always saw the temporary ADA parking and thought, well, that's kind of crazy. But after I became more educated in the process, understanding it, but it's a facility that's donated or what would you call it? I guess donate is the only thing I can say, is that a lot of churches, community organizations, businesses will offer up their facilities to the county or the city. Well, mostly the county, probably most counties, at least that's how it was in California. And I assume that's probably how it is outside of California. And I'm outside of California now and out in Tennessee. And it's very similar. I vote at a school. And so a lot of times the schools aren't necessarily ran by the county. It's maybe the state, but it's a variety of facilities that the election officials have. And so, which doesn't change the obligation. The ADA is the ADA, and voting facilities are part of your Title II program services and activities. And so you have to make those programs and services accessible. Well, you're balancing that with the whole problem, or not problem, but, you know, there's especially in the last few years, several years now, it's always been an issue to some extent, you know, that not all communities are represented and able to participate in our, you know, democratic process of voting. And so if you're closing down a facility and moving it to an accessible location, let's say you're a small jurisdiction and you only have one accessible building in your small little community, and you just went from, you know, three down to one, you know, a lot of people would argue, wait a minute, you're suppressing the vote, blah, blah, blah. You're not, you know, or this area is not, is underserved. And so now you've created another problem, or challenge, I should say, of people not being able to participate because you closed a facility down because it wasn't accessible. Then you're like, okay, well, let's go ahead and try to make it accessible, but it's an old building, you know, like this prune dryer or an old school or, you know, an old library, who knows what, you know, there's all across the United States, there's a variety of buildings that are all, you know, that have been used as voting centers for eons. And yet that obligation to make them accessible doesn't change things. It's just the realization that now we have to, you know, to address that. And so I want to give you five tips, and these aren't like official tips from the DOJ or anything like that. I'll put in the show notes a link to the polling place solutions document that the DOJ has out, and there's several links in that document that you can, you know, review. So if you're, you know, if you want like the official, you know, DOJ kind of like, you know, position on this, you know, then you can have that document. But I wanted to kind of just give you my five tips of accessible, you know, tips for accessible elections and polling places. So recently we've been doing some training for the Secretary of State's office out in California. We've been training a lot of the polling place surveyors in how to use the Secretary of State's checklist for not only the California building code, but also the federal, you know, ADA requirements. I'm not going to focus on that at all today. So for those of you who get tired of me hearing about California, this is not one of those sessions. So this is more, this applies everywhere. So it doesn't matter where you are in the United States. If you're involved in elections, surveying them or working in an elections office or any of those capacities, you know, I think these tips will help you. So, again, they're my tips kind of from experience and everything. So, I'll quit BSing and and get to the point here. Cause you're like, here, shut up, Paul. Give me the good stuff. So I'll start with tip number one here. And this is kind of DOJ's position. If you read through the document, they pretty much say, number one, you know, if you can't make the facility accessible, then you have to relocate it. Well, there's reality and then there's regulation. And so it's easy to say that and put that in a document. But again, back to my first point, that was, you know, you start shutting polling places down, now you've created a whole nother can of worms that could be an issue. And so you're trying to find that balance of keeping more voting facilities open to serve all communities with making them accessible. And a lot of these old facilities are, and the big point here is a lot of these facilities, the county or the register, the voter registrar or whatever, the authority doesn't even own the building or have the authority to go in and start, you know, even if they had the money to put in ramps and remodel, they can't because it's not their building. It's, you know, maybe it's a church or maybe it's a school or a school district or a city building that the county voting clerk doesn't even have authority over. So that's the dichotomy, if you will. So number one tip here is kind of from the DOJ perspective, and this is where you want to start. And that is start with full compliance, i.e. the removal of all barriers. You know, you always want to start there. It's like the historical building code as well in the ADA. You always start with full compliance. Make it fully accessible. Obviously, that's the 100% desire. It serves the most people with the most amount of disabilities. But like I'm mentioning here, in reality, you can't always do that. So, but we always want to start there. So start, you know, looking at your parking and your doors and your accessible route and reach ranges for the voting stations and machines and effective communication and any barriers. If money was no object and you had total control and could wave a magic wand, you would just make the whole facility compliant. However, tip number two is recognize that full compliance may not always be achievable. And that is the reality of the situation. Like I mentioned, you often case, don't even own the facility. So even if you had, you know, $1 jillion in your budget, you don't own the prune dryer. You know, the farmer owned the prune dryer and he donated it for his, you know, as part of his, you know, felt it was civic duty or whatever, or worked with the county at a, board of supervisors or whatever they're called in your jurisdiction to allow, cause it was a centrally located facility and so on and so forth. Or maybe it's a church in your community or community center that's not even owned. And so that's the problem, is even if you had the money to go in and tear everything up and make it comply, you don't have the authority cause it's not your building. Now, with that being said, I will say one caveat is with, if you are a county, and you're in the elections office or department that's responsible for accessibility compliance and voting, and you have your department head, I always recommend if you have a department head, usually can talk to the other department heads within the county for at least the county facilities. And so a lot of times you can go in and that elected official or department head can go over to the other department heads in public works or facilities and say, hey, we're doing elections at these four facilities and we found all these issues. Can we get this on the capital improvements project? Can we get it moved up the food chain? Can we find budget for it? Whatever it may be. But there's, you know, there's an opportunity there, at least with your facilities that are within the purview of the county. Cause typically it's the counties that administer most elections or the district. And the point is, whatever facilities you do have, try to get those up and get them, you know, looked at and those barriers removed. But in the cases, and my tip number two, recognize that full compliance may not always be achievable because you don't own those facilities per se. And therefore, you got to look for creative ways to provide access. Okay. That means temporary measures, signage, and things like that, which I'll talk about more in a minute. But those, you know, temporary curb ramps, cones, different things to mitigate barriers. Simply, if you have a big 6-foot wide accessible route and there's a big, you know, gap or the panels lift up and causes an abrupt edge and it's over just on the 12 inches on the left side, we'll put a cone around it. So at least during the voting session that you are using the facility, that barrier is mitigated because there's a cone or a trash can or something, even though there's still plenty of room to the right or the left of that barrier to maintain the 36 inch accessible route. Well, that's kind of a temporary measure that you can do. You can't go in and pull the concrete out, you know, on election day, you know, so you can mitigate it with some of those temporary measures. So tip number two, recognize that full compliance may not always be achievable, and look for creative ways to provide voting access anyway. And then tip number three, when you do that, use this methodology. And again, I'm going to reiterate, none of this is like official government DOJ access board. This is Paul's common sense approach, opinion, if you will, just talking practical stuff. So, you know, take it for what that is. No different if we were having some coffee at Starbucks and we were just talking about this together and talking code, hence ADA shop talk. But tip number three, when you're looking at those temporary measures and recognizing you can't always do full compliance, use what I call the approach, enter, and exit methodology. Approach, enter, and exit. Okay, so when it comes to disabled access in the built environment, it doesn't matter if you have the most accessible voting machines, the most accessible polling places. If you can't park and get into the building, what good does it do? It's just like with an office building or retail building. You might have the most accessible restrooms and the inside, or a hotel with a most accessible room, but if you don't have an accessible parking stall and a compliant accessible route to get into the building, it doesn't really do any good. And so what we do is the approach, enter, and exit methodology is start on the outside, work your way in. So if you're in a more urban setting where you have public transportation, you have a bus stop, a lot of people in those communities are traveling, you know, I'm thinking downtown San Francisco, Denver, you know, Chicago, you know, even downtown Nashville, where public transport, although Nashville's public transportation is pretty suspect, if you will, compared to most big cities, but just because it's an older city. But anyway, my point is that if the majority of your people are coming in via public transportation, then you're going to want to start more from the public way and work your way into the polling place. However, if you're in a rural setting, like the dryer that I told you was an old dryer building out in the middle of an orchard, there is no public sidewalks. I mean, it's just old country road, and there's no sidewalks or anything. So you're going to start from the parking and work your way in. So that's what I mean by approach, enter, and exit. Start with how to get into the building. And then that's why I always start with parking, because most people with disabilities, you know, will come and they'll have a van, and if they're a chair user, I mean, it's not all disabilities, but you know, for the mobility people that have, you know, a mobility device of some sort, a LARC or a chair or something, or even a walker or canes, they're going to need to be able to park. And having that accessible parking stall in close proximity to the entrance, with a compliant loading and unloading access aisle, and then a path of travel into the entrance. And so that accessible route from that parking stall, that's the approach, the enter. And then once you're inside, having a nice accessible route throughout the polling station and voting area and everything, and accessible voting machines. I mean, it depends on if they're electronic or old school at the paper, but the counters at the right heights. I recommend getting a yardstick from Home Depot or somewhere, and those are 36 inches wide. That gives you your 36 inch travel. Typically, you can run around to make sure you've got enough width for the accessible route. There's some turning and T-shaped spaces that you may need in those, and you can look at the guidelines for that. But that's the idea, is being able to approach, enter, circulate around, get to the voting activity and cast your vote, and then get back to your car back out the entrance, accessible route, back to your car and leave. And that's that methodology I'm talking about, approach, enter, and exit methodology. Now that ties into tip number four here, which is, I kind of jumped the gun, start with your parking and work your way in. And, tip three and four kind of go together. So approach, enter, and exit methodology. And then number four, start with the accessible route, accessible entrances, you know, getting into the facility. And you'll see that in the DOJ's guidelines of coming from the bus stop and the parking and getting in, and so forth. And now sometimes you can't always find an accessible parking stall. And so you can, in the worst case, or let's say you have an old facility that's, you know, that's just like not even close to accept. I mean, it's just got all kinds of barriers, and it has like, you know, I don't know, you know, steps going up, no, you know, horrible accessible route, no parking. You know, the inside doesn't even have an elevator that goes up to the second floor where all the voting machines are. I mean, it's just atrocious when it comes to accessibility. In that case, what you can do, and I'm not saying this is advocated by the DOJ or anything, but it is something I've seen executed effectively, and I think it works, and that is curbside voting. Okay, so hopefully, you know, November, depending on where you're at, could be a, could be a rain event or a you know, a weather event. But in any case, if you have a drive up where you can help serve the same function as if they were in the building, but over at curbside, you know, either with the machine, I don't know all the specifics on the different kind of machines there are, and there's the digital ones versus the paper punch ones that I've seen over the years. But if you can achieve that at the curb when they pull up and they don't have to deploy out of the car, you know, whether you're disabled or not, you could offer that up as a program mitigation, you know, to meet your program service and activities obligation under Title II. And so, you know, I think that's a reasonable way to mitigate, like, just, you know, some of the most horrible, I don't want to say horrible, the most difficult or challenging voting centers that are just, you know, so whacked out of, you know, compliance that you know, even the temporary, you know, there's just stairs, no elevator. I mean, there's all kinds of challenges. And so rather than shutting it down, maybe you, in that case, you consider doing curbside. Now, I know there's some, you know, controversy on that and whether that's acceptable by the DOJ and all this kind of stuff. But it's my experience from a practical standpoint that works pretty good in those rare cases where it's, you know, really challenging. And I've seen hybrids of both where you can park and come in, or we do curbside. And so, there's something for you to consider there. That's an option. And, so tip number four was start with your parking and work your way in. And then lastly, let's talk about tip number five, which is temporary measures are your friend. So this could be, like I said, curbside voting, temporary parking stalls, installing a cone or trash can under a projecting element. Say you got a drinking fountain or a fire extinguisher cabinet that's sticking out, you know, more than 4 inches, that's not cane detectable. Well, you can put a cone under it or a trash can, and now it becomes cane detectable, and it's a temporary mitigation of a barrier during the day or days of voting. And so that's certainly something that's acceptable. Maybe you have an abrupt edge, like I mentioned, where you put some kind of maybe a mat or a plate to mitigate the abrupt edge, or steer with cones someone around a grate or something that's a barrier, but still maintaining the 36-inch accessible route. Temporary signage is another one, and effective communication measures. So the ISA with directional signage showing clearly where the accessible route is into the voting center. And so there's all those types of temporary measures you can do. I've even seen temporary curb ramps. I know in California, there's been some challenges with some of those temporary ramps because they claim to be ADA compliant, which they are. They're typically 36 inches wide and comply with the ADA, but they don't meet California because California has some more restrictive and, they require 48 inches for an accessible route. So depending on your state, Oregon has like 44 inches. I think Florida does too. So some of you states have above and beyond the Americans with Disabilities Act widths. And so, but even with that, I still think we know that 36 works. So it's my opinion, and it's only an opinion, and that is I would rather have a 36-inch temporary curb ramp, you know, aluminum curb ramp jumping a curb than no curb ramp at all, even if it's not 100%, say, compliant with maybe, your technical state code or something like that. You got to check with your attorneys and your county council and all that stuff. But I mean, it's just my opinion that you're as a temporary thing, it seems to me that logic still works. It's not 100% compliant, but I'd rather have a 36-inch wide curb ramp that is compliant than no curb ramp at all and prevent access. That's my position or my thought process, you know, and maybe I'm, people say, don't try to confuse the situation with logic, Paul. So, you know, there's other people who say, oh, no, you can't do that, you know, blah, blah, blah. I call them code rangers. And that's fine. You know, it's each jurisdiction's call and everything. But I look for practical approaches and ways to make this work and still achieve, you know, all the initiatives that we need. So let me recap those a little bit real quick. I know I went over them kind of fast, but... And I also want to talk about restrooms because I know some of you might be going, what about restrooms? What about restrooms? So tip number one, start with full compliance first and removing all barriers, unlimited budget, unlimited. I mean, that's where you want to start. So 100% compliance. Always start from a position of that because that provides the greatest degree of access to the greatest number of people. So tip number one, start with full compliance. Tip number two, recognize that full compliance may not always be achievable. And so look for creative ways to provide access and mitigate barriers on a temporary basis. When doing that, use tip number three, which is use the approach, enter, and exit methodology. Okay, approach, enter, and exit. We got to be able to get out of our car, or come from the public way, get in, vote, and get back out. That's approach, enter, and exit. When using the approach, enter, and exit methodology, use tip number 4, which is start with your parking, work your way in, then the accessible route, then the accessible entrance, the accessible voting area, circulation paths within the voting area, reach ranges and counter heights and table heights, knee and toe space for those voting machines, and then be able to get back out. Of course, if you're in more of a rural area, an urban area, city area, where you've got lots of public way and public transportation and sidewalks, you're going to want to start from the public way and work your way and then parking. If you're more rural and you don't have sidewalks and you're out in the middle of an orchard, then you're going to start from the parking and work your way in. And then lastly, tip number 5, temporary measures are your friends. Temporary measures are your friend. And so look for those temporary cones, signage, curb ramps, curbside voting if need be, worst case, mitigating barriers. Even if you can't fix them permanently, maybe you can mitigate them temporarily. So a lot of those kinds of things, which brings me to restrooms. And so this one always comes up with polling and election places, and that is goes back to equal. If you're providing restrooms, they must be accessible. If you're not providing restrooms, then they're not required to be accessible. So if you're but the bottom line is, you don't want to say, okay, we don't have accessible restrooms, but we're going to let everybody use them anyway. Oh, except if you're disabled, that's discrimination. So, you know, if the restrooms are not accessible or there's a multitude of issues, then just shut them down on election day, lock them up, and they're not used. You could also bring in temporary accessible porta potties, you know, as a mitigation, temporary mitigation factor, possibly. You know, so it's just your call. Just be consistent. Don't say, okay, we're not going to provide accessible restrooms, but we're going to allow everybody else to use them. I mean, that's discrimination. And so that's something to consider. You know, you're not required to provide restrooms. We're not coming there to vote. To go to the restroom. We're coming there to vote. And most people are in and out. Now, you may have a facility that's super heavy use, especially on a presidential election, and you've got a 2-hour wait to get in there. Okay. That may be where, okay, we might want to consider temporary restrooms with, you know, some accessible porta potties, or we look at the actual built-in restroom in the school or the church that's being used, and is there a way to make it accessible? Or is there a single accommodation unisex restroom that is accessible that we could point with directional signage to make that one available? Maybe it's on another floor that is accessed by the elevator, like a city hall or county administrative building or something. So there's a lot of those kinds of considerations that you can look at to make it work still. Again, it's being consistent and looking at those. So you don't have to make all your restrooms accessible. However, if you provide restrooms, they are required to be accessible, but you're not required to provide restrooms, and you can shut them all down and just lock them and unavailable on election day. And then nobody uses them. And then now you don't have a discriminatory practice because it's equal. Nobody gets to use them. So not a popular one, but one nonetheless. So, so that's Paul's 5 tips. I know it's not deep in the woods of all of the specific DOJ, and there's all kinds of things we could have talked about, the HAVA funding or Elections Act. I mean, there's all kinds of state and federal, Voting Act and so forth that covers all of these things. I'm not getting into that here. Looking at it more of 5 tips. I know it's an election year for many of you, and you're trying to figure out how to make your facilities accessible, part of this election year cycle. And so these 5 tips, I think, will help you, or maybe put you at ease a little bit now that you're hearing someone else talk about it. There's just not a lot of information out there. And, like I say, there's the DOJ, checklist that they have that I'll put in the show notes that you can check. And, you know, I've done some training on this for the state, and it's just kind of the things that come up and that seem to to work from a practical standpoint, but obviously do your due diligence and look at what works for your specific agency and facilities, and take what I say with a grain of salt, because it's just me and you having some coffee on a Monday or a Tuesday, a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, whenever you're listening to this. So, all right. So next, that's pretty much the show today. I do have a free webinar coming up for ADA awareness for Title II entities and agencies. Victor and I are doing that on March 21st. 2024. It's 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific. And just going over some of the Title II, administrative requirements and so forth for Title II entities and agencies. So I'd love for you to join me there. You can sign up for that inside of the ADA Shop Talk community over at adashoptalk.com. And hey, if you have any suggestions or notes you'd like to shoot me, you can direct message me in the ADA Shop Talk community or shoot me an email at pklein@bluedag.com. Happy to hear from you and take any suggestions you might have. And one of the things I'm toying with is I'm trying to figure out if you folks enjoy the solo episodes more or the interviews. So next week we're going to have Sumo talking about federal and state housing, specifically public housing and some of the federal requirements. And we had Kaylin Dunlap. I've got a whole slew of other guests scheduled, but I'd be interested if you'd prefer the interview format or the me rambling and solo, or you like the mix of both. Either way, I'd love to hear from you. So shoot me that email or message me in the ADA Shop Talk community. I'd love to hear from you. And if you haven't subscribed to the ADA Shop Talk podcast, please do so on your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. And hey, go out there and rock your ADA efforts. And remember, let's all work together to create a world where everyone has the opportunity to thrive. And until next week, take care and keep up the great work that you do. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.